Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today is Monday, April 17th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I was expecting that we would be getting a call from John Bailey, but I tried his number a moment ago, and he was just not, he wasn't on the line. So we left a message, and hopefully he'll be calling us. And so in the meantime, we'll find out exactly what else is going on the local stage. Bailey, give me a moment because I have to go there. Didn't expect this to happen. One second here. Well, one thing is really quite interesting. This was an article written by Paul G. Kengor. He wrote an article about Jackie Robinson Day. It's really fascinating. Actually, Jackie Robinson Day began on April 15th back in 2004. So April 15th is Jackie Robinson Day, and this annual commemoration by Major League Baseball of its first black player, the man who broke the color barrier, quote-unquote, began on April 15th of 2004 when Major League Baseball officials celebrated Robinson's April 15th, 1947 debut with the iconic Brooklyn Dodgers. It turned out to be not a one-time thing. Major League Baseball now honors the day each April 15th with players and managers alike sporting Robinson's jersey number 42. It's certainly a worthy tribute. The man truly transformed America's national pastime and America itself. He fully deserves this place in history. Well, Robinson in 2013 was honored with a major motion picture titled 42, starring a talented actor and seemingly fine young man named Chadwick Boseman, who tragically departed this world way too early, as did the man he played. He most recently has been honored by a superb book by my longtime Grove City College colleague, Gary Scott Smith, titled Strength for the Fight, The Life and Faith of Jackie Robinson. What makes Professor Smith's work so thoroughly excellent is its focus on the faith of Robinson. Smith, a historian of sports and religion, including via his seminal book on faith and the presidency, is one of the few historians who understands and relates the secret to Robinson's success, which is faith. Faith, faith, faith. It inspired both Robinson and the man who brought him into baseball, Branch Rickey. Without his intense reliance on God, Robinson would have been the first to admit that he would never have persevered. He spent every night on his knees next to his bed. That was how he got through. Ronald Reagan had a favorite quote of Abraham Lincoln, which he invoked often in speeches, quote, I'm often driven to my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I have nowhere else to go. But that was where Jackie Robinson likewise found himself. Outrageously, but not surprisingly, Hollywood's rendition of the life of Robinson ignores all of that. It's another symptom of the rot of Hollywood. Gary Scott Smith's book certainly does not make that mistake. It's a thorough portrayal of Robinson's faith in life, as well as his politics. As to the latter, Jackie Robinson was a lifelong Republican, very distinctive. As Gary Scott Smith describes it, Robinson by the 1960s was a Rockefeller Republican, that is, Nelson Rockefeller. Liberals today will be eager to try to claim Robinson in that respect, given that Rockefeller was known as a liberal Republican. They must also be willing to concede that they and conservative Republicans alike detested the, quote, country club Republicanism, end quote, that Rockefeller represented. when Democrats blast Republicans as the, quote, party of the rich, end quote. Well, that was Rockefeller Republicanism. For various odd reasons, Robinson, who a generation earlier would have been banned from country clubs by Rockefeller types, took a liking to the obscenely wealthy New York governor. What further separates Robinson from today's secular left was his intense Christian faith. Again, that was the core of his life. Jackie Robinson would be aghast at the radical secularism of today's progressives. Moreover, Robinson was a strong anti-communist. In fact, he was such a committed anti-communist that the House Committee on Un-American Activities went to him in July of 1949 as a friendly witness to denounce communism. An added motivation for Congress is that another prominent black American athlete as well as singer-performer, Paul Robeson, was an outspoken Stalinist who had just said in June of 1949 that in a war between the United States and the USSR, black Americans would not fight for Uncle Sam. And that was obvious absurdity and an awful smear of fellow black Americans, huge numbers of which had just fought for America in World War II, even in segregated units. What Paul Robeson really meant was that he and his communist friends in Communist Party USA wouldn't fight for America against the Soviets. He was speaking, in effect, for himself. In his testimony before Congress, Jackie Robinson called Paul Robeson's claims about black Americans, quote, untrue, end quote, and silly, quote, end quote. And they indeed were. Paul Robeson might have been head over heels for Uncle Joe Stalin. Jackie Robinson certainly wasn't. Like Martin Luther King Jr. and like less prominent but heroic black Americans such as Manning Johnson, Jackie Robinson's staunch Christian faith was a critical factor in his opposition to atheistic communism. Quote, I am a religious man, end quote, Robinson explained to Congress in his July 1949 testimony. Quote, therefore, I cherish America where I am free to worship as I please, a privilege which some countries, including the Soviet Union, do not give. And I suspect that 999 out of 1,000 colored Americans will tell you the same. Jackie Robinson's math was spot on. Paul Robeson was the one out of 1,000 so duped by the Kremlin that he didn't know any better. Quote, I was not prepared for the happiness I see on every face in Moscow, Robeson gushed to the Daily Worker back in January 15 of 1935. After returning home from his December 1934 pilgrimage to Stalinland, where mass famine was about to kill 5 to 10 million Ukrainians and Stalin's purge were ramping up. I was aware there was no starvation here, but I was not prepared for the bounding life, the feeling of abundance and freedom that I find here wherever I turned. Wherever I turn, ropes and beams, this is home to me. I feel more kinship to the Russian people under their new society than I ever felt anywhere else. It is obvious there is no terror here, that all the masses of every race are contented and support their government. As for those who disagreed inside the grand old USSR, Paul Robeson usually said the Daily Worker, to the Daily Worker, quote, from what I have already seen of the workings of the Soviet government, I can only say that anybody who lifts his hand against it ought to be shot, quote, unquote. Yes, Paul Robeson actually said that. I have in front, I have the front page of the Daily Worker. It's why people of Robeson's day knew he was foolish, even as Robeson today is upheld by educators as a great icon of civil liberties, and as colleges like Penn State University name centers and buildings after him. The likes of Jackie Robinson could only read statements like that and sigh. Robinson was not only a keen athlete dashing around the bases, but a keen intellect. He must be remembered for what he did both on and off the field. Sadly, his time off the field was short-lived. He died in October 1972 at the age of 53. Quote, after numerous health problems, including heart disease, diabetes, failing eyesight, and substantial headaches, most notably the death of his son, Jackie Jr., in a car crash the previous year, Robinson suffered a heart attack at his home in North Stamford, Connecticut, writes Gary Scott Smith. Well, the stress and strain of integrating Major League Baseball and helping to lead the civil rights movement had taken its toll. Another great American who proceeded to recognize Robinson's contributions was President Ronald Reagan, who on March 26 of 1984 posthumously awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That day, Reagan handed the medal to Robinson's widow, Rachel, a lovely, gracious woman who is still with us today at the age of 100. Reagan said of Robinson, quote, he struck a mighty blow for equality, freedom, and the American way of life. Jackie Robinson was a good citizen, a great man, and a true American champion. On that day, baseball in America rightly pay him homage. And just so you know, Dr. Paul Kengor is a professor of political science and executive director of the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. His latest book is The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration, which was published in August of 2020. He's also the author of 11 Principles of a Reagan Conservative. His other books include A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor and Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century. So very, very fascinating. I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. Now, let's look at some other things that hopefully you'll find relevant. Bear with me a moment. 1 second. Okay, 1 second. I think we'll have enough time to read this to you. One of the major questions that I've asked here by a man by the name of Shale Horowitz, he writes the article, Why Israel is Judged Differently, Jerusalem's International Challenges, again written by Shale Horowitz. As Israel celebrates its 75th anniversary, it remains the only state in the world that is constantly threatened with extinction by immediate and more remote neighbors. Yet with a disturbing regularity that has become all too familiar over recent decades, whenever the Jewish state responds in strength to acts of aggression, it is most often chastised for its, quote, disproportionate use of force, end quote. That such opprobrium has been uniquely reserved for Israel is all the more stunning, both because it remakes a victim into an aggressor and because of the tolerant international attitude to countless conflicts that involve far harsher and more indiscriminate use of force in response to far lesser threats. How is this discrepancy to be understood, and what are its implications for Israel? Well, subtitle, Its Enemies' Genocidal Goals. From the onset of the Arab-Jewish conflict in the wake of World War I, the Arab states and the Palestinian Arabs strove to prevent the reestablishment of Jewish statehood in the Land of Israel as stipulated by the League of Nations in 1922 and its successor, the United Nations, in 1947. Failing to achieve this goal, they resolved to destroy the nation's Jewish state at birth, not to establish an Arab state on its ruins, but to divide its territory among the neighborhood of the neighboring Arab states, in the words of the Arab League's General Secretary General Abdel Rahman Azam. Quote, Transjordan's King Abdullah was to swallow up the central hill regions of Palestine with access to the Mediterranean at Gaza. The Egyptians would get the Negev. The Galilee would go to Syria, except that the coastal part as far as Akko would be added to Lebanon. Repeated battlefield defeats convinced some Arab states that military force had outlived its usefulness, culminating in the 1979 Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, followed by the Jordanian-Israeli peace treaty agreement in 1994, and the Abraham Accords with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan in 2020, many Arab states, however, have remained adamantly opposed to Israel's right to exist, joined since 1979 by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its proxy militias, notably Lebanon's Hezbollah. Nor has a single Palestinian leader from the 1920s to date reconciled himself to the idea of Jewish statehood or eschewed the desire for Israel's destruction. Even the supposed foremost indicator of Palestinian moderation, the Oslo process of the 1990s between the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, and Israel, was viewed by the PLO leadership as a strategic means to a two-state solution, Israel and Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, but to the substitution of the Palestinian Arab state for the state of Israel. Now, Israel's enemies have used all available means at their disposal to destroy the Jewish state. Israel's enemies have used all available means at their disposal to destroy the Jewish state, from economic boycott and political ostracism to recurrent interstate wars to incessant terrorist campaigns. Only during the 1948 war were Arab armies able to overrun a number of Jewish localities and to expel their entire population. Still, Israeli civilians have always been targeted for killing or deportation, the only barrier to this genocidal goal being Israel's superior power. All along, Arab statements and actions have left little doubt of the horrific fate awaiting Israel's Jewish population should it lose a single war. While seeking coexistence, by contrast, the Zionist movement and the State of Israel have always sought coexistence both with the surrounding Arab states and with the Palestinian Arabs, while seeking national and self-determination in the entire land of Israel, the Jews' ancestral homeland. Zionist and Israeli leaders, facing geopolitical and demographic constraints and self-imposed normative restrictions, have always been willing to compromise on their territorial goals. And this ranged from initial acceptance to the, quote, two-state solution, end quote, when it was first evoked in July of 1937 by the Peel Commission, and yet again by the United Nations General Assembly in November of 1947, to continue acceptance of the idea by all Israeli prime ministers in the Oslo era, with the exception of Yitzhak Rabin, who envisaged, quote, an independent Palestinian entity short of a state. In line with this thinking, a PLO-dominated Palestinian Authority, a PA, was established in 1994 and given control over 95% of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip's Palestinian residents by January 1997. In the Camp David and Annapolis summit meeting under U.S. auspices back in July of 2000 and November 2007 respectively, Israel agreed to establish a Palestinian state in all of Gaza and nearly the entire West Bank, only to be rejected by its PLO counterparts. Well, moreover, while Jerusalem's relative military power has grown substantially over time, it has posed only a limited threat to its enemies. Not only has Israel never sought to conquer and destroy the surrounding Arab states, even as they sought its destruction, but its moderation and susceptibility to great power pressure have given its enemies significant latitude to launch conventional and unconventional attacks without fear of catastrophic results. Great power intervention saved Arab armies from destruction in the 1948 and 1973 wars, prevented losses of Arab land territory in 1948 and 56, and yielded Arab territorial gains in 1973. The 1967 war, in which Israel captured and retained outstanding control of the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, was an exception that proves this rule as an outcome defied expectations based on previous conflicts. Between wars, Israel responded to terrorist attacks with retaliation, which was limited not only by the absence of far-reaching goals beyond deterrence, but also by the desire to minimize civilian casualties and to avoid escalation to an all-out war. And this restraint was in turn weakened, has weakened deterrence, often leading to a more sustained and low-intensity attacks and higher Israeli civilian and military casualties. Well, there's Israel's growing military prowess notwithstanding, its enemy's genocidal goals and its own small size have given rise to an ever-changing array of strategic threats that have left little margin for error. The 1973 war showed the devastating consequences of strategic surprise, with Egypt's newly acquired Soviet weapons nearly producing a military victory and Israel desperately seeking a large-scale U.S. replenishment of arms to stand its ground. Likewise, new and non-conventional methods and technologies have repeatedly threatened to impose huge costs and to undermine living conditions in Israel. And this ranged from cross-country, cross-border terror attacks from Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon from the 1950s to the 1980s to Lebanon-originating sustained rocket and missile attacks by the PLO and Hezbollah, to Yasser Arafat's 2000 to 2004 War of Terror, euphemized as Al-Aqsa Intifada. Well, we may have a call here, so let's just see who that is. Bear with me a moment here as I try to bring this in. 1 second.
Good morning, Hezzy. I apologize.
Good morning, John.
Good morning. I apologize. My cell phone was not on network of a 10 of 10, and I tried several times, and I was on a network. It had never happened before. It was working fine yesterday, so that's why I'm so late, but I just wanted to let
you
know.
Not to worry, John. Not to worry, John. It since happened. And
yes, technology happens. That's what happens, I think.
Yes, it does. And yes. Very well expressed as well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So
we have
a few moments to cover a couple of the items that you covered on the White Plains Citizenet reporter. So let me just get to that. Bear with me 1 second. The thing that really impacted me the most of all the articles that you posted. Where was it here? I'm trying to look. Bear with me a second. I'm trying to catch up to you now. It was the housing and the cost of housing and the reduction of people buying houses. What's going on? And why is that happening?
Well, I the way I analyze it is simply the rise in interest rates that has been perpetuated by the banks. because of the Fed raise in the cost of money. What has happened is the banks now cannot give mortgage at lower than 5% because they are not an asset.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and so why would you lend out money that costs you 5% to get, you know?
Yeah.
And just for the goodness of your heart. Remember, banks don't do anything for the goodness of their heart or for humanity. They just make money off it.
That's very true. Well, we don't have much time, unfortunately. So I do want to also cover something else that you covered, which I don't really comprehend. The Westchester County District Attorney announced a Peekskill gun buy, and she gives gift cards for guns and no questions asked, and they buy back the guns. What's the point of this process? Why are we even permitting guns to be allocated to people who file for them when we buy them back a few years later? What's the point? Who are we keeping?
Well, these are essentially guns that aren't legal. That's what's being asked for. What is fascinating to me about it, these are very successful promotions. And we've had two gun buybacks in White Plains, and they've each cleared of the streets of about 125 and 200 guns each time. But meanwhile, there have not been many other gun buybacks in the last 9 years. Why not?
Well, yeah, I don't understand that either. But then again, why do we authorize guns to be purchased and then we buy them back? Why are we even allowing them? Who needs a gun? I don't understand that. All we're doing is we're killing people. It seems every day we get more and more people getting killed by guns. For what reason? It's not to protect against, it's for a militia purpose. It's ridiculous. We don't need a militia. We've got military.
Yes. And I don't see it either. But unfortunately, there is a tremendous market in illegal guns because criminals want guns. Criminals want guns.
How do they get it? How do they get it? Legally?
Gun running. It's gun running. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is supposed to control gun running, and they don't do a very good job of it.
What about our cops? What about our cops? How come they don't control it? What's going on? Why can't we check? Why can't we check what's coming in over the roads? I don't get it. We have so much contraband that comes into Westchester County, cigarettes that are sold.
Fentanyl.
They don't even have a stamp from New York State. Because they don't pay taxes in New York State. It's come up from South Carolina, who knows where. It's insanity.
it's got to be a total no energy for enforcement. And I don't know what the answer is. You can't check every car that drives across into Westchester County. But what you can do is you can really crack down on the fentanyl epidemic, which has disappeared out of the press after, a big pally-hoo on fentanyl arrests. I mean, that's what we see. That's what amounts to enforcement. What we have is
I don't know what happened to John, but it looks like he's cut out somehow. Well, perfect timing, actually. So we're going to disconnect him because one second. Hello?
Hi, Yossi. Good morning.
Oh, how you doing? I'm sorry. I didn't realize it. It was just like John came on very late, and now you're coming on perfect timing, which is wonderful. There's a lot going on the national stage. I think I'm still freaked out. with guns. They're still killing people everywhere you look. I mean, I was shocked what happened over in Alabama.
That was a birthday party for a teenager. We still don't know who was shooting them up there. They killed, what, 4 people and injured 20-something. You know, we have had a mass shooting event more than the number of days we have spent so far in 2023. There are more mass shooting events than days. And that's the story of the United States. Unfortunately, we have a severe gun problem. No other country in the world has a Second Amendment that's been interpreted in such a way as to permit anybody basically to own any kind of weapon as long as they can pay for it. We don't even check their backgrounds. We don't even have a red flag law which would alert authorities to a person that had issues and was suspected of either carrying out a massacre or shooting themselves.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I forgive me. I was like so floored by the timeline and getting off the line with John. I forgot to introduce you as Michael Edelman because you're the national political analyst and the pundit. So what's going wrong with the whole idea of, I understand there's people are concerned, they want to be able to have a gun. Submachine guns shouldn't be sold to anybody. I don't think that takes away people's rights, that's for sure. So at the end of the day, where do we go and who's checking people who are applying for applications? And where are the guns coming from?
Well, there's plenty of guns around because gun manufacturers react to supply and demand. If there's a demand for a particular weapon, then the gun manufacturer will manufacture. The AR-15 is an Army assault rifle. That's a weapon of war. It's not even the police want these guns off the street because the police don't have the guns. And they get outnumbered. They get outshot. By criminals. So this is going to go on until we do something.
Huh. But there doesn't seem to be any progression to outlaw, the like AR-15s.
The Republicans, Hezzy, this is a political, it should not be political, but it is.
It should be.
You know, who cares? The fact the AR-15 should be taken off the streets. Actually, it was in the mid-90s under Bill Clinton. There was an assault weapons ban. And guess what? Mass casualty events went down substantially. But then it expired under George W. Bush. And as soon as that happened, everybody rushed out to buy an AR-15.
I see. I didn't know that. Wow. So
we've had experience with.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We finish your thought. So we've had experience with it, and
we've had experience with banning assault weapons, and it worked out quite nicely.
Right. And nobody was hurt.
Nobody wants to take anybody's guns away. This is not about. This is about getting an assault weapon off the streets. That's all it is. Nobody's contesting the meaning of the Second Amendment. But
and why isn't even that clear, though? Why isn't
because
that clear?
Because right-wing politicians and right-wing media have insisted that there is a right to possess any weapon, any kind of weapon, with no restrictions on it.
Well, evidently, it's not helping. I'm shocked that in a place like Dadeville in Alabama, where there was a birthday party and 4 people got killed and 28 people got injured, that the attitude in a small little place like that, which is, I don't know how many miles away from Montgomery. 57 miles from Montgomery, Alabama.
Yeah.
But it's only got 3,200 people. Don't they get it? Don't they understand that guns should be outlawed, that there's no reason for anybody to have one? Who's not protecting them? They've got a beautiful police department. What's the problem?
Yeah, well, if you have one nut that has access to a high-powered rifle, you know, all of the rationale goes away. Obviously, you know, sometimes parents are complicit because they know their kid's got a gun. They don't want to get in an argument with the kid because he's violent anyway, so they just let him have the gun.
Yeah, I guess
they don't
want to
confront their almost adult child. You know, they want to avoid confrontation. And then if the kid does something, they're stand right with them, okay? Because they know it reflects on them, and so clearly they don't want that backlash, so they. Stupid. No.
Absolutely. Well, there are other important things to. Yeah, absolutely, that too. Well, I want to ask you about something else. Starting today in Delaware, Fox News was supposed to have to contend with a lawsuit that came from Dominion Voting Systems. But that was delayed for a day. I don't know why it was delayed. But it's a $1.6 billion lawsuit.
The reason it's delayed is because they're in settlement discussions.
Oh, is that the rationale? Because I did read that might be the intent. So I guess they might be close to trying to work something out here. But at the end of the day, if it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, that's also going to be telling. Either way, it does seem that Murdoch's operation and Fox News is in trouble here. Because
they're only going to be in trouble
for their falsehood.
Yes, they have. Yes, but Fox News won't broadcast that fact. Okay, so people that watch Fox News and nothing else wouldn't be knowing what's going on with the lawsuit. I certainly hope whatever the settlement is monetarily, I hope that is included in an on-air statement that they misled their audience. And that statement ought to run for a week on Hannity's show, on Ingram's show, on the Five where Pirro appears with four other people. That apology should be given out because otherwise it still remains a secret.
Yeah. And it's amazing that people don't listen to other media, but only listen to one, you know, but I guess that's part of the political, I don't know. It's like a camaraderie. It's like a club. And I don't understand.
It's a cult.
How
it
people
be,
can,
it's
can,
a cult.
Can be so. Yeah. It has become a cult because I read more than one item. I read the Associated Press. I read Reuters. I read the New York Times. I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post.
You're interested. There you go. You're interested in facts.
Yeah, because and some people are aligned with ideas and concepts, and others are not. I just don't get it. But how can one be
Fox
so convinced?
News.
I feel it's like being proselytized. It's like
is an arm of the Republican Party, and more specifically, it is a propaganda machine for Donald Trump. They must have had Donald Trump on hundreds of times during the election. He has that's free TV for him. In addition, you have Sean Hannity who advises Trump after he goes off the air.
Yes.
You've got Jeanine Pirro. Who goes to the White? Who went to the White House to give advice to Donald Trump? She was welcomed at the White House as a staff member. Basically, she also went out and campaigned for Josh Hawley, who was running for the United States Senate in 1915, I believe it was, or 1970. Mm-hmm. She and Hannity went and appeared at a rally, which is specifically for Bolton. If you work for Fox.
Yeah, and yet Is there a lax attitude by the Murdoch operation in Fox News?
Lax. It's not lax. It's an intentional. That's the whole thing. They've got emails showing that it was their intention to mislead viewers because they didn't want the viewers to migrate to Newsmax or OAN, which are two alternate, you know, truth sites. They're not factual news sites. But they were afraid of losing viewers. And so they intentionally told their listeners what their listeners wanted to hear rather than what was fact.
Mm. Absolutely. A mind-boggling. Well, there's another issue, unless you've got something more to explain, and that's about Senator Lindsey Graham. On Sunday, he excoriated Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene over her defense of the Air National Guardsman, who was suspected of leaking a trove of classified documents. And Greene defended the alleged leaker, 21-year-old. Are we out of our mind? You know,
well, she is.
I don't know if this is going to hurt us. I'm sure it will, to some extent. Not everyone's going to say this is crazy, but say that again.
You say it's going to hurt us? Who do you
mean? I think America is hurt by this, by what happened, and it shouldn't be celebrated. I think this man should be put away. Should be imprisoned for what he's done.
Well, let's take a few steps back. Marjorie Taylor Greene said that this guy, who is an airman, a first class airman in the she said he's white, Christian, and anti-war, and we all should support him. That's what she said.
Yeah.
Lindsey Graham, on the other hand, spoke for most of the Senate when he said that saying something like that is treasonous.
I think so, too.
Because this person was giving away highly classified information without permission. And he was taken in under arrest by the FBI. And he's now in prison. And he's not getting out.
Yeah,
he's not getting out because what he did was forgivable. He tried to hurt his country, and he disregarded his own oath when he became a member of the Air Force to protect the United States Constitution. He violated his oath as an airman, and it is what it is. He's a stupid kid who didn't foresee the results of what he was going to do, but he still did it. So instead of 25 years, maybe they'll give him 15 years.
Hmm. Well, it's very frightening. Thank goodness there hasn't been any bad repercussions from even the friends that America needs to look into to see what they're doing. We're not going to even talk to America anymore, and they understand. But it is amazing. There's something wrong with our system of trying to define who should or should not be have access to all this information. A 21-year-old.
Well, you know,
it's frightening.
He was an IT, but he wasn't. He wasn't in the business of looking over strategy emails. He was only an IT specialist, which meant his job was to keep the system from up, to make sure that these emails and confidential things got to where they were going. He had no business reading them. The problem is he had access by virtue of the fact he had top secret clearance, by virtue of the fact that he was an IT guy.
Okay.
To stop.
And that's where the failure fell apart. They didn't know anything about him.
Right. They didn't vet him. Well, they could have vetted him. They didn't look at his social her media social platforms where he was posting anti-Semitic and anti-racist and racist remarks. They didn't look at that. They just gave him a security clearance. sloppy.
Well, why is that happening, though? Why aren't we more comfortable about searching out and doing the work that needs to be done? Are we just overwhelmed as a society that we can't look into these sort of things? Or is that part of the politics, too? And it's gone awry.
I don't think this has anything to do with politics. This is a failure to detect somebody who had views that were abhorrent to mainstream America and should never have allowed access to those documents. And even if he happened to have access, he should never have been taking them out. Apparently he printed them out and took them with him.
Yes. Yeah, that's the thing that's frightening.
He was bragging, so I don't think he was a foreign actor. I don't think he was being paid
was
by a foreign government.
Friends.
He was bragging to his friends who were children. They were teenagers.
Exactly. Amazing. Just amazing. Well, but I guess, you can't check on everybody. I guess that's the problem, too. And you don't know what people's attitudes are and if they're stable
or if
they're insecure.
You have to check.
It's hard.
You have to vet these people. You've got to go look at their online presence back a couple of years, see what chat rooms they go to, see who they talk to, and blah, blah, blah. And then you would pick up if that was done in this particular case, they would have found that he was unfit to have access. But the IT guy shouldn't have access anyway.
I don't think they should either. It doesn't make sense, you know?
No. So that's the problem.
Mm. So where do we go from here? Do you think there's going to be, a reevaluation of how things will get done in the future? Because this is a wake-up call, I think, because things weren't secure. How do you make
it secure?
Well,
they're going to have to figure it out. They're going to have to go back to the beginning and see who has clearance and who doesn't. And they're going to have to figure out a way that an IT guy can work on the system without having access to the system. I don't understand why somebody who's supposed to fix it mechanically would be able to read what was on it. That's two different things.
Yeah, I don't get
You're
that
fixing
either.
Your computer
I couldn't
at
understand
home.
That.
Nobody reads what's on the computer. They just fix it so it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the problem. They didn't do that.
Insanity. So what else is on your mind? What impressed you of late this past week?
I thought that the two Joshuas, both black, that were expelled from the Tennessee House of Representatives, and the one white woman who was not expelled for demonstrating on the floor of that house and demonstrating in favor of gun controls because of the recent massacre that occurred.
Yeah.
And they were booted out by the basically all-white rest of the house. But as soon as they were booted out, they became celebrities. They appeared on talk shows, and the constituencies that they represented, they were reinstated by the town council. Whoever appointed them originally reappointed both of them. So now they're there. But the point is that the whole brouhaha brought to the surface the fact that this legislature in Tennessee had no interest at all in the Louisville shooting. They had no interest in cleaning up the problem, no interest in making sure the gun laws were stricter. They had no interest, but they did have an interest in throwing these two kids out. So they'll end up, these two guys will end up touring the United States.
Yes. I think I'm just so surprised. I had no idea. I know that there's so much bias in the country, but I just had no idea it was so bigoted. I don't see people
that way. You live on the coast. You live on the coast.
Is that it?
The coasts aren't bigoted. If you lived in Knoxville or Louisville, Kentucky, or some other place, you would see, you know, the remnants of the old South.
Yeah, I've really not been to the South at all.
I'm not saying you don't go to Miami for that. Well, it's, you don't go to Miami for that. You don't go to Lauderdale for that. But you go to Pensacola, Tallahassee in Florida, same thing. You go to Alabama, you go to Louisiana, go to Missouri, Mississippi. You're going to find remnants of the old South. Less so when you're near water, interestingly enough. For example, South Carolina is very beautiful on the water, and there's no biases in Charleston, but if you go inland, there is.
Wow. What is it that captivates people to hold on to that tradition, which is what, 200 years old? Didn't expire.
That was,
you know, people live their life, and you know, they don't. It's not 200 years to them. It's whatever they grew up with.
There's still remnants of the Confederacy around.
Yes.
You know, people that when they lost the Civil War, their thinking didn't really change. They had Jim Crow laws all through the South where blacks couldn't vote, couldn't get good jobs, could not get an education because there was, look at what happened in Yonkers. There was a desegregation battle that took, what, 20 years?
20 years.
And it was, all of that is remnants of, unfortunately, the slave-holding past that this country has. We never really broke away from that in terms of thought. In the South in particular, the whites always thought that in terms of their social status, they were above black people.
Yeah.
And as long as you have, and as long as you have that thought, then whatever people want to do to give education to black people and to get rid of the vestiges of slavery, they oppose because they view it as a problem for their own social status. They view it as demeaning them, and that's unfortunate. That's going to take a while to change.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is it going to take us another 25 years or 50 years before we get there?
Well,
are we moving in that direction?
We are moving in that direction. Little by little, we're overcoming the bias. Let's not forget, in Georgia, which was a swing state, you have two Democratic senators from the U.S., Warnocky and Ossoff. One is black, one is Jewish, from the state of Georgia.
Uh-huh.
So that's progress right there.
Wow. It really is amazing. It's a different history because I think in the last few years I've realized the bias that's in the country more so than ever before because I was living in a cocoon here in New York City. So it was not as, I don't know, in my face. But I don't know. I was never born that way. My parents were not like that. So, and we didn't come from this country.
No.
I didn't see that. It's a completely different world.
If you're in Europe, you weren't slave owners, right?
Exactly.
You don't have that tradition of doing anything other than giving people of color an opportunity.
Yeah. Truly amazing. I've been reading even stuff. There are people who are black from Africa predominantly that have come to places like Germany. They feel that there's a bias there as well, which I had not heard before. But I've been reading about that because I read German and I read Deutsche Welle and all those other publications. And I see that there's talk about that now more than ever before, mostly in the last 10 to 5 years.
Germany, of course, you have the vestiges of Nazism in Germany. You've got people that want to go back to being, fascists. And that's,
yes.
You know, but the mainstream Germany, that really isn't the case, I don't think. I don't know.
No, it's not. No, it's not. Mainstream is not. No, not at all. So I guess it might be in small towns that it's happening, but it's certainly not government approved or promoted in any way that I've seen.
Exactly.
I guess everywhere there are vestiges of all kinds of bad things that happened in history, and I guess every country has got their own issues and their own concerns.
Yeah, that's true.
And eventually
yep.
they'll move beyond that. I guess that's a hope.
Hope so.
For every place.
Yep. Exactly.
Any last words from you? What else is captivating your mind?
Well, if you're watching the Republican race, you're not in Florida, but there are Donald Trump, his PAC is running ads against DeSantis in Florida on TV. Accusing him accusing him of being against Medicare Social Security based on a congressional vote he took quite a number of years ago. So that means that Donald Trump fears DeSantis in his Republican primary.
Yes,
so
he does.
You also have the fact that Asa Hutchinson, former governor of Louisiana, I believe, announced for the presidency. And he's going to run. Then you have Nikki Haley, and you have Tim Scott, who's the black senator for South Carolina. So things are getting interesting a year out from when primaries normally take place. But the big contest is actually between DeSantis and Trump at this point.
Trump. Mm-hmm. Wow. And it does look like President Biden he isn't ready to announce, but he's intending to run. His wife said
no,
so.
I know,
and
but he's keeping he's going to keep his options open.
Yeah.
No reason
that
he has to announce. Nobody else is announcing. Nobody's running against him, of note.
Nobody.
Except, Bobby Kennedy Jr., but that's silly. That's silliness. But, there's no reason he should announce. Why should he announce?
Yeah, I'm not looking for him to announce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he announces.
That's about the timeline.
He doesn't need to announce.
Okay, well,
he's got Air Force One to take him around.
Exactly. That's true. You know, I never thought of it from a financial perspective. That makes a lot of sense, too. He did very well when he went over to Ireland. I think a lot of kudos in Ireland, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people here in the United States who have an Irish background. I had no idea of his history that goes back to Ireland. It was very, very interesting. I guess there are a lot of Americans who have an Irish background, certainly in this area part of the world, in New York and in Westchester County, a lot of Irish Americans.
Correct.
It's a good history too, very very fascinating.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, anyway, I've probably stretched my time with you. I really appreciate your calling as always. Thanks for a very very invigorating discussion. All the best to
you
and the family.
See you next week. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Be well. Bye. Okay. Let's see. One second. We're pulling in our next guest. Is this Mr. Keston?
It is.
How are you? I'm so excited to be able to speak to you today. God, I've got no complaints. So I'm a happy camper. I've got to go to the doctor's office today later on, 2 o'clock appointment. But they keep checking on me, and I'm doing good, and I'm feeling better than ever, which is terrific. So I'm excited. Well, there's some really fascinating stuff that's been going on, and hopefully we can talk about it. It seems that there's a campaign against transgender rights, which mobilized conservatives, and they felt defeated when the same-sex marriage concept was somehow undermined. This is all politics. Do they have a bias against gays and transgender, or is it just that they want to engage their conservatives from a political perspective, and they use gays and transgender as like, I don't know, as a thing to trigger people to be against them and to not respect them as just human beings?
Well, as we've seen across, as we've seen across the history of politics, that low-hanging fruit, those people who are easily dehumanized, are often the recipients of political abuse. Jews in the Nazi era, blacks in the South with the Southern strategy. So these things are not
new. Even to
this
day.
Right. And it's the same groups targeted because they're minorities, so they're not too many of them. They are easily, often made easily distinguished, so it's easy to point them out. So if you can't always tell, you make them wear a pink triangle or a yellow star. If they're black, it's much more obvious. You don't have to do that kind of thing. But this is all about politics, and politicians or dictators or radical extremists figure out ways to dehumanize others so that they can build up their followers. So in the Civil War South, whites would say that no matter how bad you are, poor white trash, there's always somebody under you, and that's the black man. And so the poorest of the poor, who had much more in common with their black neighbors, would treat their black neighbors badly because it made them feel that one leg up on that ladder of society. And that's the way it was in Germany, and that's the way it was in all places around the world where we use the defamation of others in order to make ourselves feel better. There's no question that if people had the education and exposure necessary, that hate and prejudice would slowly but significantly disappear. Because fundamentally, people are people, and people are more alike than they are different. So this is political. It is power grabbing. And as we've discussed before, it is much more difficult to unite all people than to divide them. We can find those tiny little things that make us different, that seem insurmountable, when in reality, there's so much more that we have in common. Our goals, our aspirations, our dreams are much more alike than they are different.
Yeah, because that's the whole thing. I don't know why there's almost like a proclivity to focus on people's sexuality. And then the other thing too is like, if you believe in God, and so many people do, why the bias against people who may be gay or believe that they're transgendered and they want to change their sexual definition and so on and so forth? Why does that offend people? How are they encumbered by someone saying, this is who I am, this is what I believe in, and so on and so forth? It doesn't impact anybody else, does it? Because I don't see
But that's,
nobody's coming on to somebody who's straight and saying, hey, it's not happening.
Because as we just said, it's about the politics. It is not about who they are. It's about that they're different. And we magnify the differences to make ourselves feel better. The leadership of these right-wing entities, these extremist groups, magnify the differences to build a power base. And if they can use religion, if they can use the social norms, whatever they can use, they will use in order to scare their followers or their potential followers into following them, so that they have greater and greater power.
It is all a power struggle. And if people would stop and take a breath and recognize that their neighbor or their cousin or their brother or their sister or their teacher or their minister is part of the LGBTQ community, they would hate less. But there are those who like to stoke the flames because it's easier for them to gain power by stoking flames than putting them out. It's very difficult to create a society of equals than it is to create a society of unequals where you convince your followers that they're the important people and the others are trying to take away what is rightfully theirs. So this is not about gender differentials. This is not about people seeing themselves in one way but being born in a different shell. This is not about who we love or what we love. This is all about power. And it's very similar in some way when 9/11 took place and there were those who kept saying, oh, they took down the trade centers because they're jealous of our way of life. They were not jealous of our way of life.
No.
They were saying that their way of life was better.
Correct.
That their religion was better, that their belief system was better, and they were going to show us, or what they were really saying, we're going to show our followers that we are superior. We can take down their towers of capitalism. We can damage them because God is on our side. That's what this is all about. These wars, this violence, what's going on in Uganda, what's going on in Kenya, what's going on in Florida, what's going on in Texas. This is all about power and building as strong a power base as one can build. It has very little, if anything, to do with why we say we are afraid or why we say we hate or why we say these people are what they are, when in reality it has very little to do with any of that and everything to do with gaining political clout, political power. That is what allowed DeSantis to redistrict Florida and get rid of black legislators. That is what gave DeSantis power to pass legislation that is or should be criminalized itself because of how it segregates American citizens who all deserve the same constitutional rights as everyone else. It's what permitted a Donald Trump to put people on the Supreme Court that probably don't belong there, and certainly it's keeping someone on the Supreme Court who has proved over and over and over again that he should have never been put there. So this is not about our differences. It is about dehumanization and gaining political power.
Well, so is there any way to get beyond this point, or is that part of the human reality that we will always look to put other people in a lower place in order for us to extol ourselves, whether it's appropriate or not? So do we ever move toward a balance of respect? And just let people be who they want to be?
We certainly do that periodically in history, and those are joyful times. But what happens in those joyful times is we often become complacent. And when we become complacent, those haters, those power-hungry people, those people who want more and more and more, will raise their ugly heads and regain the power that they need by dehumanizing others, by questioning the rights of others, by saying that the people that are like them are losing what is rightfully theirs. No, we're losing political power. No, we're not able to have the children we need. No, we're not doing this. We're not doing that. But it's all really an attempt to bring things back to when they felt they were in charge. Of course, those times never truly existed in the way that they claim, but Fantasy is always more beautiful than reality.
That's very true. I'm also surprised, which I never, ever expected would happen in all places in America, where there are places in different parts of the country where they don't want libraries to carry certain books. What's going on? I mean, I thought we would be able to read anything and everything that was available. And are the libraries picking up? The libraries had books for years. All of a sudden, they're no good. Is that also to put people in their place?
Putting people in their place, that, you know, it's a loaded term.
Yeah, it is. So what is the point of banning books? Why is that happening?
To silence those who are trying to bring people together.
People
who believe in people don't try to cancel out other people. They understand that not everything is going to be pleasant, but they do understand that everything needs to be discussed so that it is shown to be divisive rather than uniting. But if you hide it, then it gains power. If you try to keep people from accessing it, it gains power. And so it is better to let things out in the open and let people realize, hey, this isn't good for us. But in this case, they want to silence the material so that people don't know how similar we all are.
Well, you know, I guess I was raised in a way to aspire to know people who were better than I. I wasn't jealous of them. I was just hungry to know more because I knew how I was aware that I knew little. I'm not a simple guy, but at the same time, I'm not the most brilliant guy in the room. I mean, does everyone think that they're at the top of the food chain and they need to demean somebody else in order to feel empowered somehow? It makes no sense. I mean, are they uncomfortable about who they are? I mean, everyone's got limitations. One way or the other, you may be terrific in one thing and you may be deficient in something else. But that's the whole point. That's the challenge. That's why you bump into people who are brilliant. And they know something different than I do. And that's a challenge. Hey, why don't you learn it? Why don't you get into it? Why don't you involve yourself more? Or does that not happen? I guess to most people it does. They're challenged by seeing something that's better, different, and they're not undermined by somebody's color of their skin or their religion or their background or what country they come from or, you know, the color of their skin. I don't know. It seems so anathema to me.
It's if you feel good about yourself, if you feel comfortable with who you are, then those things are not threats. They're appreciated. If you're uncomfortable, if you do not have good self-esteem, then they are a threat.
I guess so. Is there a way to move society forward, or is that still not known? Or is that a personal choice? People say, well, I'm not going to be used by political dogma because I'm supposed to be I need to feel better than somebody else, so I'm going to put them down. How do we move beyond that? Do we need to be homogeneous? Is that the problem? Is that part of our societal problem? No, it's not, right? We can't do that.
Our problem is that people are not exposed to other things. And so when they are confronted with other things, they find them scary or different. And that makes them uncomfortable, and nobody wants to be uncomfortable. So instead of learning, instead of finding new as a worthy thing, they shut down and close out, and then they react accordingly. When you're frightened, you act out. when you're angry, you act out. So our educational systems have to change. The ways we expose people to new and exciting things has to change. Look, when television started, when radio started, people complained. You know, these things are a danger. These
really?
Oh, absolutely. When computers came about, when cell phones came about, when technology changes, people's first act is resistance, and that's why sometimes it can take a long time for certain things to catch on. The reality is all of those things have good potential and bad potential. It's mm-hmm. how you use them, how you instruct their use. And it's the same thing with culture, you know. Some people like certain kind of music. Some people like other kinds of music. Some people say their music, speaking about other people, is not music at all. It's just noise. But is it noise? Or do you not know what you're listening to and how it evolved mm-hmm. over time? You know, so there's just a lack of information. We, in the United States anyway, teach to tests. So there's really no real learning. There is old-style rote education, and that is terribly unhelpful in a society and in a world that changes so dramatically every single day.
Yeah.
You know, change is hard for people, but if in instruction change is implemented, then people know how to adjust better. And right now we are not good adjusters. We are not malleable. We do not find comfort in the fact that things go on. And so we rebel. And it's a dangerous place to be in a world that is moving faster than the speed of light. We really need dramatic changes. We need to become lifelong learners. We need to understand what makes us tick and what makes our neighbors tick. And we have to do the kinds of things that are right to build a stronger, more civil society. All of that is hard.
How do we become more malleable? Because evidently a lot of people are not. They're just like stuck in their world. And it's like, it makes no sense. Because, are people that afraid to learn something new, to learn a new word, to learn a new trade? What's so frightening about that? I mean, it's a challenge. Don't get me wrong. I understand it's a challenge. But that's part of the excitement, too. How do you move from place to place?
One would think that the excitement in life is the fact that things change, that the one constant in life is change. But for most people, they get in a rut and they stay in that rut because it's easier. Human beings like what's easy. And what's
that's
easy
a comfort
is often
zone?
Not right. People like to stay in that comfort zone. It's just like right now, I just got a post on something that I commented that governments really need to take a stand on what's going on in Uganda, where members of the LGBTQ community are being killed every day.
Yes,
they're being killed in Kenya every day.
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
Those countries get foreign aid from the West. They get foreign aid from the UN.
Mm-hmm.
They get assistance so that their government can stay in place. And it is time that governments call people out. Now, someone just put, what right do we have telling another country how to rule their citizens when their culture and beliefs are theirs to choose? Well, I would start my comment on that is that, for one thing, countries, especially in places like Africa, were artificially created by the West.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those countries did not have those borders or boundaries that they were given.
Right.
So all countries are an artifice of human nature and human beings. There is no real such thing as a country. It is a mindset. Yeah, there's certain
correct
countries with good land barriers or water barriers, But for the most part, they're just artificial. Where Texas begins and Mexico ends, at one point part of Texas was Mexico. At one point parts of North America were entwined. They were either British or they were French. They weren't America. They weren't the United States of America. And the same is true all over Europe and Asia and Africa. So for one thing, countries only exist in our minds and in legal documents, but in terms of human beings, countries are an artifice that makes life easier because they can issue passports, they can do other things. So what does one country have the right to call out another country? Did we not learn anything from the Second World War? Did we not learn that the cultures of some places, the traditions, the laws of some places are absolutely wrong and need to be called out? I would hope so. And then this telling another country how to rule their citizens. Any place where a country rules its citizens is in default of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where people make those decisions, not countries, not rulers. Yeah. We need countries that reflect the people that live there, that treat everyone as equal and everyone as a citizen, and no citizen anywhere the legal or moral or ethical right to determine by the state to take someone else's life, especially not just because of who they love or because of what God they believe in or what books they read. So it's absolutely crazy to me that someone would suggest that countries devoid of their people have rights. The only reason that exists is to keep certain people in power over other people, and that in and of itself should be criminal.
It was a very interesting. Aung San Suu Kyi, she's still in prison after all these years, and yet there's still reverberation of democracy, and people still adore her after so many years in prison. And it's amazing that people can think that way despite all that's happened. Again, but then you've got power struggle there in order to diminish her, I guess, her aura, which transcends not only her country, but around the world. And it's amazing people don't recognize that.
But she also tarnished that image when she allowed her government, when she was out of prison, to target the Rohingya. That was a mistake on her part. It was a political decision, not an ethical and moral decision. And I think that you hear a lot less people talking about her in the same way they did before because she sold out.
Yeah, that's very true. So how do people lose their way? Is it because of politics? They get deflected? They think it's going to work for them?
Well, I think in her case, she felt that they needed to get somewhere before they could get somewhere else. And if she took those stands, people might have turned against the progressive movements that they were trying to make. And so she let that go in order to potentially achieve a greater good. That greater good did not come. And in fact, what happened is that people turned against simply because she and others did not adhere to the very strong values that they proclaimed. And once those values that were proclaimed were no longer respected, then nothing was respected. And so she ends up back in jail because to some extent she wasn't who she said she was.
Yeah. Amazing. Oh, you know what's really fascinating? And this is really, really a mind blower. This only happened in the last day or so. Reza Pahlavi, the former Shah of Iran, his son, is going to visit, of all places, Israel. And he's never been there before. But certainly the former Shah was a good friend of Israel and vice versa. You know, what causes something like that to happen? Because he's got to be in his 50s now. He's got to be my age. Well, actually, no, I'm 70 now. But he's got to be closer to my age. Maybe he's 50 or 60, I don't know. But what would cause somebody like that to go over there? Is that to reclaim part of history, to feel what it was like? Or is that, an effort to somehow gain prowess back in Iran?
There's so many strands that would go into that. Many strands that come from that, you know. We have to remember, one, the Shah was a dictator and a brutal one at
that.
Yes,
he was.
He was put into power by the American government. He was not selected by the people of Iran.
No.
When he was overthrown, the wealthy Iranians, including the wealthy Iranian Jews, fled. They didn't flee to find democracy. They didn't flee to find justice. They fled to protect their wealth.
It's very well said.
So it's very hard to say why at this particular moment, when Israel's democracy is being ripped and is torn, that someone that represents a former dictatorship would venture to go to Israel.
Yeah, I was really quite shocked. It's like out of the blue. Very, very fascinating. It's always hard to make a judgment call one way or the other of why people do what they do.
There are a lot of rich Iranian Jews living in the United States and probably a few other places around the world. So him going to Israel at this time and undoubtedly will meet with Netanyahu boosts a very wealthy and powerfully political establishment in the United States and elsewhere at a time when Netanyahu is being attacked and criticized because of his anti-democratic actions. So this could be a very dangerous thing for Israel and the rest of the world, but a good thing for the Shah's son and a good thing for Netanyahu, which is not necessarily a good thing for Israel or for Israelis.
Yeah, we'll have to see where that goes. Unbelievable. Well, any last words, as always? It's always a pleasure to talk to you because of such great insight that you have. What made you focus on all of this? How did you even get into it?
Well, two things, I guess. One, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and it became ever clear to me as a very young child that until we are all free, none of us are free. Two, in a Westchester strip mall back in 1969, 1970, whatever it was, when Bobby Kennedy was running for the U.S. Senate, they set up a stage in a parking lot. While my mother was at the beauty parlor, remember there used to be beauty parlors, and he came to speak, and I was this little kid, and I wrangled my way all the way up to the front of the stage, and he leaned over and shook my hand, and at that point, he had been transformed from someone who worked for Joe McCarthy to the spiritual leader of human rights and equality and justice in America running for president. Or running for the Senate at that time and soon to run for president. And those two things, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, were motivational when I was extraordinarily young. And so everything that I have tried to do, not always successfully, but tried to do, has been to realize those two dreams and bring them together.
How exciting. That's a beautiful, beautiful history. Very, very nice. And then that was just like a happenstance. So it's good that your mother went to the beauty parlor.
there are no mistakes in history.
None at all. Well, that is a blessing. Well, again, as always, thank you so much Always exciting talking to you.
Thank
all
you.
The best.
You too. Be
thank
well.
You. Thank you. You too. All the best. Well, there we have it. Unbelievable. But does it ever get better than these people? It's amazing. Robert Keston, he's the director, the executive director of the People's Movement for Human Rights Learning. You could find his thinking, which was formulated by the Shulamit Koenig, and you could find him at the pdhre.org website. So P like Papa, D like David, H Hotel, R like Robert, E like Echo.org, pdhre.org. Really very, very exciting. Well, thing is, I've got to go to the hospital for a checkup. So I've got to get my act together. So we're not going to continue to the last half hour. And I guess that's about it. But tomorrow's another day, so we'll catch up with you then. And I appreciate everybody who's been on with us today. And we'll go from there. So take care and be well. Goodbye. And let me just close out from the show. There we are. And we're ending.